Very good. So, I'd like to get yourselves comfy. A few people are coming in, a few people are going out. So I can get ready for tonight's Dhamma talk. There's not so many people tonight. Must be something good on the TV. What's on the TV tonight? Anything? Football tomorrow? Tonight, that's what it is. Very good. So anyway, I always prefer quality to quantity. So tonight we don't have any riffraff. Just the real hardcore followers of the Friday night talks. The Friday night junkies. Online as well. I'm told it's over there now, the cameras. So hi, those listening overseas. So, I always sometimes have some idea of what I'm going to talk about on a Friday night talk. But usually, if I have an idea of what I'm going to talk about, I usually change it at the last moment, which is far more interesting. And so, to let you know that not tomorrow I am going to Melbourne, but I've just come back from Canberra. I really travel around a lot. And I should be so tired and exhausted and stressed out. But the reason I went to Canberra is because last Wednesday, the 10th, it was the real full moon day, the day of Vaisak, the holiest day in the Buddhist year. And we decided to try and get a foothold, a crack in the door of the federal parliament. So we had a reception in federal parliament to try and start to get some recognition for what we're doing in this in Australia. And because of that, I wanted to read out what I read out to the politicians. It's a very, very quick message. And it really sums up why I had to go to Canberra just to read this out. This was actually a letter to the editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, from a fellow called Dennis Hannigan in Toowoon Bay, which is somewhere in New South Wales. He begins, "I don't know about the Christians and Muslims, but I'm greatly concerned about those Buddhists. It is simply un-Australian, the manner in which they are so kind, gentle and tolerant, never seeking headlines or whinging about how they are treated. Can this be quickly addressed before it spreads?" And I thought that was a very wonderful little... I read that out before, I think, at the last conference we did here. So interesting just how just ordinary people in this world regard Buddhism as being... so kind, gentle and tolerant, never seeking headlines or whinging about how they are treated. Can this be quickly addressed because it's un-Australian? But the point is, we're changing Australian society and world society by having these beautiful little attitudes of being tolerant and not whinging and being kind. What is wrong with that? It would be a wonderful place if more people were so tolerant and kind. And it means we would get less stress, which is the topic of this evening's talk, because people were complaining to me before we came into this room. They're so stressed out. They have to work so hard, and they have bosses which are just impossible to deal with, and the economy is no good, and we don't even have a job, and what are we going to do next? Life is so stressful. But I work harder than anybody. I just said traveling over the world, serving my boss, the Buddha. He's very, very gentle, very tolerant, very kind. Never tells me off. Even I tell very bad jokes here, they'll never hear anything from behind me. So, today's talk is learning how to deal with stress, and I should know how about that, because you all know that the reason I'm going to Melbourne is because I'm also spiritual advisor of the Buddhist Society of Victoria, and so I'll have a meeting with their committee and also the monastery, Newbury Monastery, as well as giving many talks and doing many things. Oh, my workload is huge. Isn't that the case, Venerable Kasapa? Yes, very good. See, I'm his boss and he does what I say. That means he is so scared of me. No, he's not. But I do work very hard, but I learn how not to have any stress, and it's not that hard to do. It's not the work or your duties which make you stressful. It's totally the attitude you have to what you are asked to do in this world. You cannot really choose how much work you have to do. Sometimes that's just given to you. There are times that, you know, I'm a senior monk here, sometimes that you get into a really big problem. You get sick, you get cancer, you get into hospital, you're dying or you're dead. And people actually ask me, can you please come and help? How can you say no to that? You know, when I've known you for such a long time, if you need some help, of course I'll stop what I'm doing and help you out. So my time is not my own. You have to help so many other people. And it's one of the reasons why that when there is a time when I'm teaching a retreat, or especially as I often say, every year for 3 months during our range retreat, we try and sort of not do so much. And so just out of compassion to help me deal with the workload which I have, that's why I always request all the people who come to this center, especially those who are members who I've got obligations for, please, during the 3 months retreat time, please don't be selfish. Don't just think of yourself and just die. Please wait until the retreat's over. Think of somebody else for a change. Think of poor Ajahn Brahm will have to come to your funeral. So please, I always ask people, out of faith, out of compassion, don't die during our retreat period. But you know, there's some people that just only think for themselves, they die when they want to. They're totally selfish, unconsiderate of all the monks and other people who have to come to your funeral. So you can see you can't do such stuff. So instead, understanding that you cannot control life and trying to control it is one of the biggest causes of stress. That you just let life be instead of trying to drive life to suit yourself when you want it to happen. And when you don't go to war with life, when you stop fighting what you cannot change, then you find there is hardly any stress at all. Somebody once showed me a video, a TED talk, and on that TED talk there was some very, very perceptive young woman. She was a psychologist, and her field of study was, why is it that some CEOs in high-stress jobs get cardiac problems while others do not? Is it genetic, or is there something else at work that doesn't give the signs of stress? And very good research discovered that CEOs with the same or similar amounts of responsibilities, similar workloads, similar genetic makeups, that the reason why some got cardiac problems while others didn't was simply their attitude to their responsibilities. Those who develop negativity, I don't want this, why me, it's not fair, those were the ones who got high cholesterol, cardiac problems, whereas the others who were saying, give me more, this is a challenge, it's a wonderful thing I'm doing, who saw the positive side of the workload they had, those were the ones who got no cardiac problems at all. And the reason I love that little piece of innovative science was that it showed the cause of stress in our modern world has nothing to do with the amount of work you have, or the problems you face in life, or the difficult challenges which are put in front of you, which come uninvited. It's nothing to do with that at all. Everything to do with the negativity or the positivity which we add onto life. Last week I talked about ultimate reality. And reality, I never got that far, is actually what we create upon this life. The reality is, much of it, is what we create. So stress is not out there which we are a victim of. Much of stress is what we create for ourselves. Mind made by our negativity. The why me? This is unfair. Why do I have to do all of this? Well, I was trained by great teachers to say, oh, stop complaining, just do it. Because when we complain, that makes the work so much harder. The classic story, which is in opening the door of your heart, was when my master, this is a difference between stress and dealing with life with fun, no stress at all, and enjoying ridiculous amounts of work. My teacher, Ajahn Chah, had just built his hall, and there was lots of earth left over. And instead of paying people or getting earth movers to move that earth, why pay money when you've got so many slaves like me, young monks? In those days, I was fit, I was healthy, I was handsome, not fat and old like today. But I didn't mind helping a teacher. It was like gratitude. When someone had helped you so much, you just, please, give me something to do. I just want to help you. And so he asked us to please move this earth. All the leftover earth to put it in the place around the back. Now that was not easy. It was 3 days of hard slog. We'd only eat one meal a day. And you really couldn't even call it a meal. It was just subsistence rations. Just sticky rice with a frog on the top. That was one of the meals. It was rotten fish curry. It stank. It was, well, that's what we had to eat. Because this is what the villagers ate. There was snail soup. I remember the snail soup. But that was just so disgusting. Because the snails are so chewy. You know, it's really hard to sort of break them up. You know, like those rubbers you use to erase pencils? That's what it was like, it reminded me of. That was one of the common ones. Or the fried crickets, the bugs, the ant soup. Ant egg soup was very common. Or buffalo afterbirth. That was vegetarian food. Think about it. It doesn't harm the animal at all. It's just extra. But anyway, really gross food. And then from 9 o'clock on till about 10 o'clock in the evening, shoveling earth into the wheelbarrows, pushing it, you know, to where it needed to go, a huge amount, 3 days' work, and it was so hot. It was in the jungle. And there was so many mosquitoes. And it was so tiring. He didn't have time to have, wasn't any lunch or any afternoon snacks or dinner. He only had one meal a day. Wow. Even prisoners of war never had to work that hard. And I had faith, though. After 3 days, it was all finished. You can imagine how dirty you felt, how sweaty. All your robes stank, and just, you know, you didn't have time for a shower. As soon as you got back to your hut, you just collapsed, and you woke up in the morning, arms round, have a quick meal, and then, bam, moving the earth again. 3 days of really, really hard work, but it was finished. And when I went to bed after the third day, I thought, great, tomorrow I can have a really good wash, I wash my robes and do some meditation, just relax a bit. But that night, my master Ajahn Chah, he went to visit another monastery, just like I'm doing tomorrow. We do those things, we visit each other, help each other out. And that morning after our breakfast, the deputy monk, he made an announcement. He said, "I've been thinking of where we put that earth. It's the wrong place," he said. "We need to move it." And you know, he, that deputy monk, he never pushed a wheelbarrow, never touched it. He was one of the bosses. You know what bosses are like? They always tell you what to do, but they never do anything themselves. All full of ideas, but no experience. So, 3 more days of hard work in the jungle, pushing those wheelbarrows, shoveling the earth, but I still had faith. After 6 days it was finished, because, you know, the deputy monk had a point. You know, well, it was in the wrong place. And that night, guess what happened? Ajahn Chah came back. And the following morning, after breakfast, he said, "I told you to put it over here. Why did you put it over there? Move it!" And it was at that point, I lost my faith. I never became a monk to move wheelbarrows of earth. I came to meditate, become enlightened, you know, learn the Dhamma. And that's what I was a monk for, not as a labourer, not as a slave. I got very angry. And, you know, I did say, I think in the book, it's absolutely true, you did start to swear in English, thinking that, you know, the Thai monks couldn't understand you. But of course I understood. The body language showed you're really, really unhappy. And that, I was stressed out. I was angry. And for a good reason, you're being exploited. You're being taken advantage of. And I was so angry and upset. And that's when one of the Thai monks came up to me and he said something which I will never forget, which I've shared with thousands of people, one of the great ways of overcoming stress in life. He said to me, "Pushing the wheelbarrow is easy. Thinking about it is the hard part." Ooh. You know, that was worth all of that torture. Just to learn that. Pushing the wheelbarrow is the hard part. Going to work with a terrible boss, that's easy. Thinking about it is the problem. Having to do all of that job, being the president of the Buddhist Society of West Australia, that's easy. Thinking about it is a hard part. And of course, once I got it straight away, you know, the rest of the 3 days went really quick. And it was fun. You know, we'd have races with the other monks, who got there first. And if they beat me, you know, just for a bit of revenge, you know, I was shoveling the next bit of earth, and it was, "Oh, just sorry that I didn't get it in the wheelbarrow, got over your face." Shoveling earth over each other. Just a bit of fun and games, playing around. And that was really good fun. After 9 days, it was finished. Now, finally they decided, you know, where they wanted that blooming earth. So I can then have a good rest. But I learned so much from that. I learned how a lot of stress is all about, I don't want to do this. Complaining, thinking about it, thinking I can't do this, thinking it's not fair, instead of just doing it. doing things is very easy in life. So even all the hard schedule which I have, sometimes you don't sleep very much, you get up really early, you cross time zones, people want to talk to you, doing it is so easy. Thinking about it is the hard part. And the other thing is making it fun. So when you're at work, are you allowed to play around at work? Some of you come and see our monastery. A few of you have been visiting recently, and some of you go past our whatever we are, and we're always cracking jokes and messing around and being totally disrespectful of the abbot. And I encourage that, because otherwise you get very, very stressed out. Just like the story I was telling recently, I don't know if you heard, but you know, the Anglican Church and the Catholic Church were trying to sort of get some reconciliation, trying to move together, both Christian groups. And in the end, they couldn't really reconcile, so they decided to let God choose which was the right form of Christianity. And the way they were going to do this was the Archbishop and the Pope. They both liked golf, so they decided to play 18 holes of golf. Whoever won, if the Archbishop of Canterbury won, the Pope would become a Protestant. It would be God's will. And if the Pope won, the Archbishop would convert to being a Catholic together with all the Protestants. And that way they could unite and it would be God's choice. Fair enough. If you believe in divine intervention, so let God decide who's the best. Who's the most authentic? The Catholics or the Anglicans? So they started their round of golf. They got to the last hole, the 18th hole. The Archbishop had already put his ball into the hole. The Pope was two shots ahead. If he sank this 18-foot putt, he would win. And the Anglican Archbishop, together with every Anglican in the world, would have to convert to being Catholics. So you can imagine the stress of that shot. He was so nervous, he hit it way too hard. And it went way past the hole, maybe 6 foot past. He missed his first opportunity. He's still one shot ahead. And so he lost it. He swore. "Damn it, missed," he said. And his caddy, because all these golfers have to have caddies, guess who his caddy was? It was one of the Catholic nuns. I won't explain why, but I think you mostly know. So the Catholic nun saw the Pope swear, "Damn it, miss," and said, "Your Grace or Your Holiness, you shouldn't swear like that. That's a sin. You shouldn't do that." She's looking up in the sky. Said, "Oh, I was stressed out, too excited, I'm terribly sorry, and I won't do it again." And she had another shot. If he hold this shot, he'd still win by one hole. So he's still the Archbishop would have to become a Catholic. So he really relaxed, tried to get rid of his anxiety and stress. He hit the ball again. Not hard enough. Only went halfway to the hole. "Damn it, missed," he said. And the poor nun looked up in the sky across herself and said, "Don't do that! You're tempting fate in your position. You should know better." "I'm terribly sorry, sister. This stress, the anxiety, the stakes are so high." He had one more shot. If he missed this one, he'd have to become a Protestant. He had to hold this one to draw. The stakes were really high. And so he hit the ball. It went straight to the hole. But it just went on the outside and missed. And this time he really swore loudly. "Damn it, missed," he said. And before the nun could cross herself, there was this huge clap of thunder from the sky. And a lightning bolt came down from the clouds and hit the nun. Why are you laughing at that? And the nun dropped down dead. And a great voice from the sky boomed out, "Damn it, missed." And I should get excommunicated for that. Totally irreverent. I'm going to get some complaints. Probably already the Pope and the Archbishop are trying to sort of put in their complaints on the computer. But But when you laugh, does the stress get released? Of course it does. The attitude which we have to life, if we can just, you know, don't think about it, but just do it, and see the fun in it, make some joy out of whatever you have to do in life, then again it becomes stress-free. I was told even when I was a school teacher, if you make the lesson enjoyable and fun, the kids learn much more. They actually remember what you're saying. And I remember one lesson, it was Pythagoras' theorem, for those who remember that. And I said, imagine there's a triangle. I drew a triangle, a right angle triangle on the board. A, B, D. And they said, sir, it's A, B, C. I said, no, the tide's out, so you can't see the sea. Simple joke like that. And I carried on like that. The kids actually paid attention. So a little thing like that is just how I enjoy the teaching, the kids enjoy the teaching, and learning happens, growth happens. It's our attitude which we put into life. Now, of course, the other thing is we always wanted to try and please others. That is a great form of stress. I've given up trying to please others. If you're fed up with these jokes because you've heard them before, then just turn off. You know, the great thing about people who listen to these talks online is they have the delete button, which they can press any time they like. Even here, people can walk out any time they like. We often say that we don't have an entrance fee to come and listen to these talks, but there's an exit fee. No, there's no exit fees at all. So if we're worried what other people think about us, our performance, that is so incredibly stressful. So, why are you worried what other people think of you? Why do you allow other people's opinions to control you? They haven't got a clue, you know, why you do things. So for a lot of my life, imagine coming to Perth 33 years ago dressed like this. You should have seen some of the remarks which people gave me when I walked down the street. You don't hide, you know. I don't wear other clothes, you know, when I'm out on the street. No, this is all you wear every day. You've got no other. Even though when I went to, how long ago I actually went to hospital for 5-6 days? That was about 26 years ago now. Yeah, 26 years ago was the last time I went to hospital. It was in Rockingham Hospital. It's very interesting because the fellow who looked after me is actually the secretary, Geeta's father, and he's a gynecologist. But because he knew me, sort of, he said, oh no, I'll take you in and I'll look after you. So on the bed, there was no Ajahn Brahm, doctor, Dr. Mendes, gynecologist. I already looked weird enough wearing his robes, but being under a gynecologist, that was really cool. And all the nurses, what are you? That's good fun. But especially when you check in, you know, you've got to check in first of all. The first question they ask me at the reception, where's your pyjamas? Monks don't have pyjamas. But you've got to have pyjamas. Well, I don't have any. But you have to. It's listen, it's these robes or nothing. Take your choice. And actually they let me wear my robes. So you have great fun being a monk. Don't worry what other people think of you, but enjoy the fun and games. Like that time on Leech Highway. If you know Leech Highway, it was a 3-lane highway on both sides. The medium strip was hardly anything there. But anyway, it's one of these hot days in summer, 40 degrees plus. And we had this old combi van, the old VW van. I was in a passenger seat. One of the Anagarikas was the driver. We were driving along there with the windows down because no aircon. Windows down, trying to get a bit of breeze to keep cool. And this car full of, you know, young men, maybe about 19, 20. They saw me in this car, this weird guy, bald head, brown robes. They decided to have some fun. So they drove alongside of us and they said, get your hair cut, you know, get a proper job, you bludger. all that sort of stuff, you know, which people do. But then when we got to the lights, red lights, they came right next to us, had, you know, a couple of minutes. So there's one of the guys there, you know, he was in the driver's seat, you know, he took his hands off the wheel, he got out a magazine, he was going to me. And I was in the passenger seat, so I had a look, and you know what it was? Playboy. Said, Playboy magazine. He's just trying to wind a monk up. At least he knew we were celibate. And, you know, what did I do? Did I get embarrassed? Of course not. I started laughing. But did I look? No. Of course not. I'm a good monk. So how did I know it was Playboy magazine? Because my driver looked and told me. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. But I laughed too, because if I was a young kid like that, I would have done the same. So this is, you don't allow people to control your happiness. You don't get stressed out what other people think about you or say about you. And that way, a lot of stress disappears. You know, when you're young, your mum and dad tell you what to do and how you should behave and how you should look, and you must get a partner, and you must get married, you must have kids, and they just put the pressure on you. And a lot of people spend all their life trying to please somebody else. Exactly. So you can't please other people. Mistakes happen and you laugh at it, instead of getting embarrassed. It's one of the things which I was taught, and simple stress reduction teachings. When you do make a mistake and people start laughing at you, then you laugh as well. Then the world never laughs at you, it only laughs with you. This is a beautiful teaching. So you make a mistake and you just allow it to be, and you laugh at yourself as you laugh with others whenever a mistake happens. And that's one of the other things which lessens stress. Allow mistakes. If you don't allow mistakes, then you really get stressed out. Number one, trying not to make a mistake, and then hiding it once you've made the mistake. That is so stressful. For me, I allow myself to make mistakes, and after making the mistake, I tell everybody about it. That's why, I like telling my mistakes. What's one of the mistakes which I made? Actually, this was some years ago. You know, when I started wearing glasses, Amanda wrote this in I think my biography book. I was leaving Bodhinyana Monastery to come here on a Friday night, and it was halfway down Kingsbury Drive, and I said, Amanda was my driver, and said, you've got to turn around. I looked in my bag, I left my glasses in the monastery. You've got to turn around, I need that, you know, read all the documents for the committee. And he turned to me and said, Ajahn, have you checked on top of your nose? I looked in my bag, I looked in the glove box, I looked everywhere, except where my glasses actually were, on the top of my nose. Has that ever happened to you? Yes. So I allow those mistakes. Or some of the other stupid mistakes, I'm trying to think of some of the stupid mistakes which I've made. I told a lot of them already. But when you do make a mistake, oh, what's a really nice mistake? Oh, a funeral. He was a Sri Lankan disciple here a long time ago. This was in Rockaby Road in Subiaco. He said, you know, my parent has died, can you please come and do the funeral? I said, yeah. But sometimes that I don't do my research properly. So I went to there to the funeral parlor. You've been to funerals before, they're really serious. You only, you know, actually in Buddhism you die many times, but people don't realize that. So you die once and people want it to be done correctly. So I went up there and people were really somber, very sad case. And so I went up there to the lectern to welcome everybody and say thank you for coming to the funeral. I didn't know their name because, you know, quite honestly, some Sri Lankan names are very, very long. And, you know, and so I said to the disciple, I knew the disciple's name, this young man, I said, we're coming to, for her, his mother who's passed away, and it's very, very sad, she's a very good woman. And as I was going through my speech, this old woman at the front, she stood up, said, it's not me who's dead, it's my husband. I had a 50-50 chance of getting it right, and I blew it. I should have found out, you see, which one is dead? Is it your dad or your mum? But sometimes you don't like saying things like that, that may upset them. You know, which one is then, they might burst into tears. So you just, you know, you take a guess, hope for the best, and it was the wrong one. That was a very memorable funeral, that was. No one could be serious after that. Everyone took it well. They laughed at my stupidity. I got it wrong. Oh, what was one of those other times? I was in the community hall doing a marriage. You know, for one of the members of the Thai community, this young girl getting married. And so she came in the procession, you know, all the relations were on either side. She came in and, you know, she was she was in her early 20s, but she looked like she was about 16. She looked really, really young. And you know, the guy who brought her in the hall was, you know, really, you know, maybe same age as me, maybe 50 or 60 or something. And I said to him, he said, oh, are you acting as the father of the bride? You know what happened next? He gave me one of the most dirtiest looks. I am not the father of the bride, I'm the groom. Imagine that in front of all your relations and friends. Oh, I never got any donations for that one. They make mistakes. You don't hide it. I celebrate mistakes, because when people celebrate mistakes, well, where is Don, our treasurer? Yeah. No, because we were having a committee meeting a couple of years ago, and he was sitting on one of these old chairs of the Buddha Society. I shouldn't really say this, because occupational health and safety will probably fine us. He was sitting on one of the chairs, and it collapsed. He said, what type of chair man are you? He said, he broke the chair instead of taking the chair. So that was a very lovely meeting as well. Very memorable. So when things go wrong, Jenny's not here, one of my favourite funeral services when they go wrong, people don't get embarrassed. They just enjoy it, because that was an open funeral at Fremantle Cemetery. You know, not one of the chapels. You've got, like, you do the ceremony here, and you take the box over to Fremantle, and they're just outside. They've got a little conveyor belt. You put it on there, do your stuff, and it just goes inside and gets cremated. But at the time, it's actually my fault, because I found out legally you don't have to buy a coffin, you can make your own. But it has to be a certain size. And because this fellow was into white water rafting, he made it in the shape of a boat with little paddles on the top. And it was him, it was who he was. The trouble was, they made it out of jarrah, which is incredibly heavy wood. So just getting it out of the hearse and onto the... It took about 10 people to actually lift it up and put it on there. That was okay. But after the ceremony, when you do the committal of the coffin, you press a little button and the conveyor belt sort of goes, and the little glass partition moves back, all synchronized. It goes through and the glass partition closes. What happened? It was so heavy, that poor motor was struggling to move the conveyor belt. So it only got halfway through when the glass door closed and jammed against it. Halfway in, halfway out. You know what the wife did? The wife, grieving for a lovely husband, she jumped on the conveyor belt and started to push. And everyone said, are you trying to get rid of him that much? And it was a big mistake, but instead of getting embarrassed, everybody started laughing. One of his friends reminded everybody that, you know, he knew him before he got married. You know, when he first got his first car, he crashed his first car on his first day driving it, just like the first day in his coffin, he's crashed that too. Typical of Steve. That was such a memorable funeral, because everything went wrong. Oh, like I will always remind Dennis, he's our marriage celebrants. I've done so many marriages with him. We did one up at Yanchep once, and oh, he was just to announce, I now pronounce you husband and wife. And I said, Dennis, what? You forgot the rings. He hadn't done the ring ceremony, put actually the rings on people. Yeah. Dennis knows, he doesn't worry about me telling that because I tell that to so many people. Big mistake, getting married without any rings. But anyway, so we all make mistakes. So instead of being stressed out, what happens if I make a mistake? What happens if I don't get it right? What happens if things go wrong? Instead of worrying about that, we allow mistakes to happen. Because we're not so stressed out, mistakes don't happen. It's the stress and the worry cause the mistakes. When we relax and enjoy life, then things don't tend to go wrong. And when they do, we embrace and rejoice them as part of life. Isn't it wonderful when things go wrong? When I was in Sydney recently, I was interviewed, supposed to be SBS, but it was actually audio, by this Russell Arnott. Apparently he was one of the Sri Lankan cricketers a long time ago. Is that right, Russell Arnott or something? Yeah. But anyway, we were just talking about cricket. And I always remember the BBC Test Match Special, when I used to listen to that as a kid, you know, when there's a cricket match on. And there was this famous BBC commentator called Johnson. Anyway, he was just the one who was considered to be the best BBC commentator. And it did happen that England were playing the West Indies. And as he was commentating, and actually got through the BBC censors before they realised it had gone to air, because the Englishman who was actually bowling was, I think, something, was it Jack Willie, I think his name was. And anyway, the West Indian batsman was William Holding. Very, very famous batsman for West Indies. And so he introduced the start of the over. The batsman's holding the bowler's willy. And it went out on BBC. Big mistake. And everyone was too polite to laugh until it went to where the batsman's holding the bowler's willy. Mistakes, they happen. I'm not just being crude. That actually happened on the BBC about 30 years ago. Isn't it lovely that when we can make a mistake, which is really embarrassing, and not get embarrassed about it, but actually laugh at it? And when we do things like that, we don't get stressed anymore. When we don't get stressed, it means we usually perform to a much higher level. So that's the other thing with stress. Please allow yourself to make mistakes. Learn from mistakes. Laugh from mistakes. And then a lot of the stress is removed. So, the other thing with stress, of course, is our anxiety. What are you anxious about? Again, just like mistakes, we think, oh, something terrible is going to happen. Oh, I'm so stressed out about the nature of the world. Oh, climate change, the sea levels are going to rise. But look, I always look at things in a positive way. Where I live, at Serpentine, it's the top of the hill, if the sea levels rise, we have a beachside monastery. I always wanted to live next to the beach. You know, I can have some sand there, put a few deck chairs out for the monks. You know, have all the anagarikas serving us nice iced tea in the afternoon as we meditate on recliners. It's already like a resort, but this will be really the full-on resort by the beach. Okay, what about all those other people who lose their homes and stuff? Well, they can all come and join me, monks. What about the state of the economy? The people say that even in West Australia there's still a lot of unemployment. We are taking on more staff. Last week I employed two more staff at Birding Yarn and Moss. We had an ordination for two new novices. My business is flourishing. That's why I'm going out to Buddhist Society Victoria next week. One of our monks is already over there, Venerable Chunda. And one of our monks, actually, who is it? Venerable Sunyo is at the Cambodian Buddhist Society. Where are the other monks? We're all over the place. Because Bodhinyana Monastery has actually, Dhammasara is just beginning to start. We actually started a new business. It's called Rent-a-Monk Service. So the Cambodian Buddhist Society has rented one of our monks. Actually, you were there just recently. You were hired out to the Cambodian Buddhist Society. I've been rented out for a few days. And I just came back from Sydney. Santi Monastery, I was rented out there for a few days. So we do a very, very successful business and rent a monk service and rent a nun service, because there's many places in the world don't have good monks and good nuns. So, you know, we just... So that's why my business is thriving. So if you're out of a job, there we go. There's many opportunities in our world. So you can see, when you think of things in a positive light, instead of, ooh, negative, ooh, it's all going to go wrong, ooh, oh, I've got a headache, it's a cancer, I know it's a cancer. Look, if you think like that, you make it into what you expect. When I say the last week's talk about reality, we create reality much more than you expect. With negativity, you create a negative world. What you see in other people is what they show you back. That's part of the talk last week. Don't treat the schizophrenia, treat the other part of the patient. They're not a bad person. That person does a bad thing. But you can see some more in them instead of the badness. When you start looking like that, it's incredibly powerful teaching. What you see in others, they show you. You are creating our world much more than you expect. The last little thing, I'm just going to say this because I'm surprised that you forgot this, that Barbara asked me, just the last little addendum to this talk, she said, where is the mind? You had actually asked a few people, where is the mind? Where is the mind? And I said, look, it doesn't exist in space. He said, well, I can't really explain that to other people. And that's where I said the marvelous answer, and this actually understands what stress is the story of one of my best friends in Cambridge. He became in the diplomatic service. He was a consul in China for a while. I always thought he was in the MI6. Still think he probably is, but he'd never admit it. But his daughter, in the first grade at school, the first grade at school in England, teacher asked the question, what is the biggest thing in the world? It's a great question for grade ones. My daddy's the biggest thing in the world. You can understand that. No. Elephant. I was in the zoo today. Elephant's much bigger than her daddy. No, miss. A mountain is much bigger than an elephant. No, miss, said the daughter of my friend. My eye is the biggest thing in the world. And the teacher couldn't understand, what the heck are you talking about, your eye? And the little five-year-old genius said, well, my eye can see her daddy, and it can see an elephant and a mountain and so much more. If all of that can fit into my eye must be the biggest thing in the world. Great logic from a five-year-old. The way we see things, we turn it around a different way, and we get this incredible wisdom. And so there's such an astounding piece of ways of looking, perspectives. Your eyes are the biggest thing in the world because everything can fit into it. But then I said 9 out of 10, but not the full marks. Because your mind can see everything your eye would ever see. And your mind can imagine things you'll never see in the real world. Your mind can hear real sounds, imaginary ones. It can smell, it can taste, it can feel touches, real and phantom limbs. And it can know so much more. Everything which can ever be known or experienced by you can fit into your mind. So, your mind is the biggest thing. You may notice I never said biggest thing in the world. The biggest thing. Because the world can be experienced and known. It is in your mind. Not the mind in the world. That's why you can never say the mind is in here or anywhere. The world fits into your mind. Not the other way around. So, if you can make a beautiful mind, a positive mind, a kind mind, then everything which fits into it gets soaked with the lack of stress, with happiness, with peace, because that's where it fits, not the other way around. So if you want to get rid of stress, so easy. Stress is in the mind. Get the mind peaceful, happy, positive. Don't worry what other people think about you. Don't worry if they tell you off, they try to embarrass you like they do me. Just let it be. It's part of life. And then, if your mind is peaceful and pure, everything is peaceful and pure. No stress whatsoever. Peace at last. Thank you for listening. Very good. Okay, if you want to clap as well. Very good. Yay! Thank you. Anyone going to shout encore, encore, encore? That's what they used to do. Okay, we got a question over there, first of all. I always like to, those who are actually in Perth, you can bring this here and they can ask the question there afterwards. Very good. Or we have someone, Archbishop Canterbury, Lambeth Palace. Wouldn't it be great if you had something like that one day? Okay, your question. Yeah, over there, there's a question. Got the hand up. Very good. Yes.
Thanks very much, Ajahn Brahm.
Oh, is that your question? Okay, very good. No.
So, you were talking about, trying not to please other people.
Yeah.
And then, you know, allowed to make mistake. And I was thinking that... there's actually a lot of the time that we kind of hold responsibility for other toward other people, and if we make a mistake, it's kind of have full flow-on impact on other people, and they are not very forgiving. So how can we deal with those kind of situations?
First of all, if you're afraid of making mistakes, you get so tense you make more mistakes. So actually allowing mistakes ends up by making fewer mistakes. That's the first thing. So the goal is actually, you've got responsibility for other people. It does have a flow and effect. You don't want to harm other people. So allow mistakes. And then less mistakes will happen. And number two, it doesn't matter how responsible you are, how careful, how smart, you will make mistakes. So, when it happens, because you allow mistakes, then you don't hide them and try and cover them up. So you learn from mistakes. If we don't allow them, if we think they're terrible stuff, then the flow and effect gets worse because we don't learn from them, we cover them up, we don't admit them, people don't know until it's far too late. So, rationally, allowing mistakes means less mistakes, and also we learn from them much quicker because we don't get so embarrassed, we admit it straight away. That's what happens. Okay, let's see what we got from the dawn in the USA. Dawn already in the USA. There must be about right, 12 o'clock. How do you stop the body from feeling stressed? My mind may understand logically, but body still feels anxiety or stress. If usually the mind begins the stress. So if the mind is very peaceful, because I sometimes, you know, sitting long time, just doing lots of busyness, sometimes my body feels tight. But when my mind becomes so relaxed, the whole body just relaxes with it. You find usually your body will follow the mind. So if the mind is relaxed, oh yeah, you can be tight here, just let it be. Then the body actually doesn't feel any tightness. If the body is tight, sometimes in meditation I imagine, visualize this part of my body, the muscles are being pulled apart. Like a rubber band being stretched. And if you stretch a rubber band, how do you actually relieve that stress? By looking at both ends and letting go of both ends. So I imagine if I feel some tightness, I imagine it's like a rubber band being pulled tight and I let go of both ends. When I let go of both ends, yeah, I can feel the relaxation happening. The awareness, the mindfulness of the body, you can actually feel the changes in the tightness, the relaxation in your body. You get to know it. You get to know your body so well, you can feel it. And that means that after a while you can just relax it, just by a matter of will. Just like, I won't say who this monk is, he had terrible pain in his spine, and that was because he had some congenital deformation in his spine. Doctors at that time, he had a CT scan, and said nothing you can do about it. But the doctor said, I'd advise not meditating, because that makes it worse. Well, I'm a monk, that's what I do. But fortunately, he found this excellent book, and of how, a long time ago, how to use some mindfulness to cure the problem. Because his spine was too weak, and it was causing some problems. But, said this little book, there are muscles on either side of your spine which most people aren't aware of at all. Because you don't need to be. Much of your body, you don't need to be aware of it. So you're not. So the book says, start off, take your hand and rub those muscles on either side of the spine as an exercise every day for an hour or something, every day. Because when you're actually touching them, you can actually feel the sensation of your, and now my thumb touching one of those muscles. And that creates a connection in your mind, a neural connection. The more you do that, the more you can be aware of those muscles, the more sensitive they become. Until you can actually feel those muscles without needing to touch them. Just as I can feel my nose without needing to touch it, I can feel my hand without needing to touch it. It becomes sensitive. And then once you can actually be mindful of those muscles, trial and error, try and move them. After a while, he learned how to move those muscles at will, because now he was mindful of them, he could do something with them. Now, exercise them. Stretch them, relax them, stretch them, relax them, stretch them, relax them. So he did that. And then after stretching and relaxing them for a few months, those muscles became so strong, much stronger than other people's muscles, that they perfectly compensate for the weakness in his spine. Now he can sit meditation, no pain anymore. Very beautiful example, just of how a bit of awareness gives you some control over parts of your body. You can actually not just exercise them, but relax them, loosen them. Mindfulness gives you the awareness, and just try to never know how to relax, how to tighten them up if you need to. You have some control over your body parts. So that's actually how we did that. So you can use that with anxiety and stress. Feel a part of the body which is stressful and just relax it away. Now from Israel, stress causes me sleep problems and nightmares. Does meditation help get rid of nightmares? Ah, very easy. But I don't know why you want to get rid of nightmares, because I always say, especially if you haven't got much money and you're looking for getting more income, have the nightmare, write it down, and it can become a wonderful script for these horror movies of zombies or The Walking Dead or whatever. I've never seen The Walking Dead, but apparently it's one of the... Is it TV or movies or something? TV, okay. Because they're always looking for new scripts, new ideas. And there you are, you've got a great nightmare. Why waste it? You can make a fortune with your crazy nightmares. So, number one, see the positive side of having a nightmare. But if you're fed up with nightmares because they wake you up and you can't get enough sleep, what it really, how to overcome that? Develop the mindfulness and you make the resolution. Tonight, you relax before you go to sleep, doing the relaxation which we do in meditation. Once you relax, you say, I will have a peaceful, beautiful sleep. I'll have a peaceful, beautiful sleep. I'll have a peaceful, beautiful sleep. Program your mind by giving it instructions. It's amazing how well that works. Call it self-hypnosis, auto-suggestion, but it works. You've got to make a clear instruction to your mind. Listen to what you're saying, repeat it 3 times, and then don't worry about it, and you should have a wonderful night's sleep. Last, you said, oh, this, did I tell the story of, okay, I'm going to get in trouble again, here we go, but it's a really great yarn, about the story of the guy who I had to share a room with the snorer. Did I say that last week? No, no. Okay, there's a guy, he was travelling, he checked into a hotel and said, sorry sir, there's no free rooms. No rooms are free. He said, look, I'm desperate, have you got anything? He said, well, there is a twin chair, but, and the fellow in the other bed, he doesn't mind people sleeping in the same room, but he's a terrible snorer. No one is ever able to get a good night's sleep in the same room with this guy. He snores just like an elephant. And the guest said, oh, it's no problem at all, I'll take the room. So in the morning when the guy checks out, he said, how did you go getting sleep? I slept perfectly, no problem at all. How on earth did you manage that? It's so easy. As soon as I got my pyjamas on, I went over to the other guy, gave him a big kiss, and he stayed awake all night. Emotional intelligence. from Cairns. Terrible joke, I'm terrible, sorry. It's going to upset somebody. You said controlling life causes stress. How do we find a balance between a changing life and letting go in our lives? Can we even really control our lives? You can't control lives. You have plans, but they're made out of rubber. You learn how to adapt to life instead of trying to control life. And when you adapt, the stress actually goes. You know, so I'm supposed to be going to the airport tomorrow morning. The guy taking me there doesn't turn up. Doesn't matter. Not my fault. And if people don't like it, I say, well, not my fault. Blame somebody else. I always have somebody else to blame. That's one way of overcoming stress. I always have some buck to pass. That's why, you know, even like being a Christian, you know, it's God's will, God's will, God's will. You know, I can't do anything. But, or if you know a Buddhist, you can't really blame God. You say, well, it's karma, you know, karma. Obviously, the karma of the people in Victoria wasn't good enough. That's why, you know, it didn't happen. So you can't blame me. You can't blame my driver. It's just karma. Always find someone to blame. That isn't stress. But for praise, if it's praise, always take responsibility. If I give a good talk and say, a great talk, I should blame. Oh, yes, exactly. Thank you. I deserve that. But if it's something I do wrong, I say, well, you know, it's just because, you know, that I had to talk with the president and all these other people afterwards, I was a bit tired, and so it's their fault, nothing to do with me. Should give me more of a break. Always find someone to blame. No, you can't do that, just things happen. So, changing life and letting go in our lives, We actually just, look, there's always things happen in life. You do literally go with the flow. You adapt to the moment, living in the present moment. You have to live sometime in the future, but as least possible. For goodness sake, don't live in the past. That's dead, it's gone, it can't be changed. And it's the most stupid, ridiculous thing is to worry about what happened in the past. You can't fix it up. And you don't learn from it, you just get depressed by it. So, changing life and letting go in our lives, living the present moment, a little bit in the future, but the future is just so bendy that you can adapt to any change which happens in life. And that way you can have a lovely life, nice and peaceful. So thank you all for listening, and thank you for staying on a bit long. If I spoke too long, it's not my fault. Okay, so let's pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha and then see what happens.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantā abhivādhe suvākato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi suppatipanno Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho Sanghaṃ Namāmi